And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us with the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, Leslie, it's Mark this morning.
Oh, good morning, Mark.
Good morning. You know, that's not snowing. We're not expecting a lot of snow. But as far as the snowpack is concerned, these strong winds are loading slopes, and the snowpack doesn't know any different. It's still extra weight and extra load, and that's increasing the avalanche danger today to considerable. These winds are blowing 20 to 30 miles per hour, gusting 40 to 50 miles per hour from the south-southwest at many elevations. In fact, I think most of the lifts at the Canyons Village side of Park City are not even open yet this morning due to winds. So that's creating both wind slabs and the additional load of that windblown snow is going to make persistent slab avalanches likely. There was one triggered yesterday above Canyons Village in the backcountry, and that was before the winds got going. So with the winds stripping snow off one side of the mountain, putting it on the other, the avalanche danger has gone up to considerable today.
Okay, dangerous conditions. Hey, thanks, Mark.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Well, about a half hour before last night's Park City Planning Commission meeting was to begin, Park City Municipal sent out an announcement that the meeting for Treasure Hill, a development that started more than 30 years ago, was canceled and a press release would be submitted. That press release has come out basically saying that the city is in negotiations with a 100% buy down of the density. That means no roads, no houses, no hotel, just 100% open space. Last night, Mayor Andy Bierman explained.
We got a pleasant surprise call this morning. We've been speaking with the property owner several times every day recently, trying to get this development agreement put together in time. Of course, we've been pressing along the way for a full buy-down. We continue to hear that from the public, the council, and the planning commission, that they would really prefer a full buy-down. And we've been pressing it with no progress. But this morning, we were pleased to get a call where the property owner said, we are interested in a full buy-down, and we'd like to have that discussion. And those discussions went very quickly, and we reached an agreement in principle for 100% buy down of Treasure Hill.
He hopes to have the agreement signed tomorrow. A letter of intent has been signed, but makes no promises. As of last night, he was not ready to divulge the purchase price, but again, that price is at $64 million. The property owners, he says, will withdraw their development agreement.
I think that's probably a good thing because despite heroic efforts on all sides, I don't think it was going to get done in time. We had a strict timeline, and the property owner realized how complicated it was, and the specifics that needed to be provided probably weren't going to be ready on time. And I think combine that with the fact that they repeatedly heard public input and heard from us that we wanted a full buy down, got them thinking perhaps that that was an easier road to go and that something would go over much better with the public and increase the success of the bond.
Planning Commission Chairman Adam Strawn has stayed on well past the end of his term at the former mayor's request. In order to stay on top of the Treasure Hill application, Strawn told KPCW he has no regrets.
The goal always is to reach a result that is the best from the planning perspective and from the public's perspective. And this is the result I think that the public wants the most. It's a result I'm happy with. And the fact that we put in a lot of work on an application, so be it. That's the job you sign up for, and it's a job I signed up for, and it's a job I'm going to resign from as soon as this thing's closed.
That's the chair of the Park City Planning Commission, Adam Strawn. Joining me now in the studio is Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you had sent out an email about an hour ago saying that the purchase price will be $64 million. The city, however, will only bond for $50 million. So where does that $14 million come from?
Well, there's $6 million that we've already established that we were willing to cancel or delay the brew pub project, and that frees up approximately $6 million that we would put down on a deposit of this if it's approved by the council to move forward with the purchase, which is very similar to what we were talking to with the settlement. So that takes us down six, and then we're going to take a hard look at our capital projects and areas that we can either cancel or delay to bring up some more funding. And we are really excited to come back to the public with what they've been asking for, but we're also sensitive to the fact there's a lot of bond fatigue. It continues to there are accumulating costs on our residents, so we're going to try to get this down as low as possible. And we've put 50 out there as a target. If we can get it lower, great. If we if the projects that we're proposing to cut the public objects to, then it might be a little bit higher. But we would really like to get it in that 50 range.
Yeah. Anything you can identify in terms of capital projects that could be cut?
It's kind of early at this point. This all came together yesterday, and we were really focused on getting it here. So we will go through our entire capital project budget. We will also look. The city owns properties around town, and maybe there are some properties we can dispose of to fundraise. Maybe there are some operational costs we can cut back. We're going to take a look at all options here.
Yeah, word on the street is that we're looking at maybe selling the brew pub parking lot instead of developing it. Is that a possibility?
That would be an option. If we're not going to develop it, it's underutilized, and selling that could help us in two ways. It would save us the cost of building it out as a park, and it would also raise additional funding we could put towards this purchase.
Right. Is it zoned commercial, HCB?
I believe so. I can't say for certain, but based on its location, I think commercial development would be appropriate there.
Yeah. So what's changed? I mean, we have spent an incredible amount of time over this last month preparing plans, and now this.
Yeah, and we've made a lot of progress on the settlement agreement we were working on. We'd been talking with the property owners daily. We had a good council meeting this Tuesday. However, I think it became clear to the property owners that this is incredibly complex, and despite the fact somewhat heroic efforts on all sides, we weren't getting the information the Planning Commission needed to I believe, want to move forward with this, and we had a firm deadline. So I think based on the fact that they continue to hear from the public and the council and the Planning Commission, we'd rather have a full buyout and the complexity of all this, they finally came around to reconsidering their position, which they didn't want to sell all of it. And we were thrilled.
Now, I'm guessing, did the developer put pencil to paper and realize that taking this would be a sure profit? No guarantees at a 120-room hotel and an 18 home subdivision would get them even close to this price.
Well, that one's hard to say. Certainly the subdivision, the 18 home subdivision, if you do the quick math on that, based on what lots are selling for in Old Town right now and around town, they could probably get $2 to $3 million a lot for those lots. So that's a quick cost recovery. Of course, they've got to put some roads and infrastructure in, which offset that and gets expensive. The hotel is more speculative. I think the applicant looked at this or the property owner and said, hey, the long-term play, we could make a lot more money on this, but there's an incredible level of complexity, and there's time and possible litigation and all these factors that they took the time-money equation into account. And I think really through this whole process, I got to credit the Planning Commission and thank our residents for really demonstrating to the applicant or the property owner that this is something they weren't just going to get used to. They had real issues with it, and they had real concerns. And I think that steady pressure started to wear off on them, and they realized, maybe it's better just to take money for this and give the residents of Park City what they want.
You told KPCW last night it was really a very simple agreement, not a lot of moving parts, as you put it. So what do you mean by that? What are we talking about?
Well, it's a straight-up land purchase. Where you look at the settlement agreement, we had hundreds of questions and things we had to pin down before we go forward with this. This really is a matter of we need to take public input. The council needs to consider it based upon that input. And other than having a discussion whether we can afford this as a community, there are very little moving parts. It would then be bought and preserved.
Yeah. The budget department has put together a table showing that legally we could bond for another $250 million, except that the city has a policy that would mean we could only bond for half of that. So we've got about $125 million worth of bond debt capacity. So you're feeling pretty confident that we're okay here in extending ourselves this
far? Well, the city's incredibly financially healthy, and we have the AAA bond rating, which is the top you can possibly get, and we don't spend beyond our means. We are fortunate to have a very strong municipal budget, one of the strongest ones in the state. So we can afford to do this. The question is, what impacts does it have on our residents? We have to be very careful. And as we're aware, sometime in the future, near future, there's some real spending that's going to need to happen with the schools. So we're just trying to prioritize and figure it out. But technically, yes, we have plenty of bond capacity. And something that's important to know is we're talking about doing bonds. We have some large bonds dropping off in the next 2 years as well. So any new bonds we incur will mostly be wiped out by the ones that drop off. In terms terms of we're taking on new debt, but we're also dropping off debt, which means your monthly or your annual tax bills will go down. So there's a bit of a wash there. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be careful about what we bond for and how we spend our money.
The table shows that primary homeowners, because of the discount we receive from the state, only responsible for about $9 million of the city's total $59 million in outstanding debt. So that means that businesses and second homeowners responsible for paying off the other $50 million. Any concern that we're going over the top here? Maybe not so much for our second homeowners. I mean, the fact that they got second homes means they got some money, but our local businesses.
Well, until recently, I was a small business owner and ran my own business in town for 20 years. And I think we were often overlooked when folks say, yeah, second homeowners and tourists pay the way. The businesses do get impacted, but businesses also benefit from these. Growth is not always good for local business. And I think that's something that many of the small merchants, actually, we've exceeded what I would say is healthy growth. It creates too much competition. It creates too much congestion. It tends to attract the larger chains to town. So we need to take that into account. Again, we need to be mindful, though, because it is a bigger burden for them. And we're going to have that conversation. The beauty of this is it's a community choice. We're going to look at this, and if the community sees value and this is how they want to shape this town and spend the money to shape the town in this manner, then they can. If not, we can go back to the original treasure proposal and we'll get a large project built on the hill.
Yeah, and that's my next question. I mean, worst case scenario, voters don't approve the bond. Do we go back to 17.2 or do we go back to this half buyout?
No, we go back to 17.2 at this point. I think if the voters speak loudly, they don't want to approve this bond. Certainly, they wouldn't approve half of it for something they don't like either. So I think at that point, we would go back to 17.2, and the $6 million would be non-refundable. So that would go towards a 10% buy down of that 17.2 project.
Did you say $6 million or $16
million? $6
million. Yeah, okay. Think organizers were out celebrating once they heard the news, but premature?
They deserve a celebration. This community has gone through the rigors with this for a long time. And I cannot tell you how many countless hours that Think representatives have spent in those meetings. And I'm really hopeful. I think all parties are committed to this. And it's really in the public's hands at this point to come to us and let us know if they support this. And if they do, council will move forward.
So as of next week, then, we expect to see some kind of settlement agreement, basically outlining what you've told me.
Yeah, you're not going to see much more in there. Like I said, it's very simple, but we're going to get signatures on a settlement agreement. It will be discussed publicly in our council meeting on February 1st, and we have roughly targeted the 15th for an approval discussion. If council and the public are in support of this, we will try to approve it on the 15th. If we need to add special meetings or hearings, we will do that between now and then.
All right. And in the meantime, it just kind of goes away until we start gearing up for an election, a bond election in November. Huh?
Yeah, I don't think it'll go away. I think it'll be $64 million is a lot for this community.
But I mean Treasure itself.
Oh, Treasure itself. Yeah, there will be no activity. I just think there will be a lot of discussion about it.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to add about that?
I just got to say I'm really excited, and I thank the property owners for listening to us. I got a nice text from one of them this morning who said, you know, I really wanted to move forward with this project, but I've received emails and communications from residents how excited they are, and that makes her feel good. She's happy about that and is feeling that this is the right direction. So I thank the public for their patience. I'm sorry this has taken so many twists and turns, but I think the latest turn is a positive one.
Did the Sweeneys get their $6 million check?
Yep. No one's received any money yet. I mean, at this point, we just have an agreement and we have to go through the full public process. If we decide to move forward and take a vote on it, then there would be a deposit.
Okay. Changing topics here. Any word from legal department on when we may expect to hear those audio tapes about the closed sessions?
No, legal's been a little busy with this with this turn on Treasure Hill. I believe you've submitted a grammar request and we will process that.
Yeah. Tuesday's meeting, you said that you felt like you have rectified this situation. We were told it would actually take some kind of court order for the council to officially void the action. So does that get done or what?
Well, I don't think council is trying to officially void the action. We made the mistake, and we own that. It was something that we unfortunately received incorrect advice, and we did what we thought was appropriate, and it wasn't. So we have apologized to the public, and what we tried to do was basically a redo. We took very good notes during that process, and so we had already intended to talk about it in the public setting before we made our decision, but we were very more expansive than we had planned on. We read through our notes and talked about each candidate and tried to represent what part of that discussion was so the public would get a view of it. I think if you go back and you look at the criteria that we sent all the candidates and talked about, and I believe I've shared with KPCW, we picked the best candidate according to the criteria, and we are really excited to have Lynn coming on board as our new council member.
So when does she get sworn in?
February 1st.
Mm-hmm. People asking me, and I don't know how to answer it, how can this appointment be legal if the action was done illegally?
The action wasn't done illegally. We deliberated and made the selection in a public meeting, as we were required to do. The mistake we made is post-interviews, we had some discussions about character in a closed meeting, which is very typical for any time you do hires or you select for boards in that. It turns out there is a piece of state law that doesn't allow us to do that, and we missed that piece, and we apologize for that. We take our public trust very seriously, and we feel badly that it went this way. I had been an applicant that had gone through this process, and I found it really uncomfortable and weird. So we tried extra hard to keep this as transparent as possible and even over-communicate with our candidates, and it turns out we made a mistake, which is on us. But I don't think it nullifies the process, and certainly all the candidates I've heard from are comfortable with the process. They feel like they were treated fairly.
Yeah. And also people asking, we would never have been in this place if you had just resigned your city council seat in the first place with a decision to run for mayor. How come that didn't happen?
Do you mean in June?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, if I didn't win the mayor's race, I would have been able to stay on for an additional 2 years for council. And I felt an obligation. I had made a commitment to the community to stay on council for 4 years when I ran, and they reelected me. And I intended to do that. It would be very unusual to resign a council seat to for a campaign
of
this sort.
We do it all kinds of other, when people decide they're going to maybe run for president, they resign their Senate seat that's how it's done in many other.
It's possible. It would have been a little presumptuous when we had a very strong field that I was going to get elected. Now, I was one of three strong candidates, and the likelihood when I put in, there was a very good likelihood that I would have lost that race, and then I would have neither been on council or mayor. So it didn't make a lot of sense, and I don't think, I didn't hear a lot of pressure from the public that I should do that. If it was something that the public felt strongly about and asked me to do, I would have considered that at the time, but I actually heard the opposite. Some people were criticizing me for leaving council early to be mayor, which I feel is kind of an internal shift. It's a shift. We're all on council. It's just a move to leadership, but I took a little heat for that.
Yeah, and so this appointment was all about somebody fitting in. I mean, because that's what we're hearing, as opposed to kind of broadening the council. We kind of have somebody that's, a company person, let's put it that way.
No, I got to disagree with that, Leslie. I don't know where you're hearing that from, but really, we had a lot of good candidates. You know, we probably had five super qualified candidates. We boiled that down to three. But what really made Liz stand out were a couple of characteristics. One is her experience attending council meetings, first as a reporter working for KPCW and then as a staffer. She has nearly 6 years of her belt of attending almost all of our council meetings and many of our planning commission meetings, as well as almost all the community forums. So she had a base of knowledge which stood out above and beyond the other candidates. Even Josh and Diane, who had been recently attending meetings, or Alex, who had served on council. But one of the things that she brings to this council, which we think is an important dimension, is she speaks Spanish. She has been our liaison to the Latino community for 18 months, as well as our liaison to the senior community. So she has got a ton of work and great relationships with the two of the main communities we want to work with on our social equity efforts. So she brought a dimension to council that we did not otherwise have, and it was in an area that we knew we were weak and we knew we wanted to move forward. The fact that she was familiar and a friend to several of us was actually a liability for her in the discussions. We looked at that, and we didn't want the public to feel like there was favoritism. And so we discussed, you know, should we go with the less controversial candidate? But she was so much stronger than all the other candidates. We figured we would weather that criticism because we felt like she was going to be the best candidate for the community.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just I want to say I've been really happy with Sundance so far. I won't say the traffic's gone away, but the traffic management seems to be working for the most part. People seem to be orderly and having fun. So let's finish strong.
Lots of parking in China Bridge. Just saying. It's 8:15. It's 8:30. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Utah legislature opened its 45-day session on Monday, and KPCW plans to provide weekly updates on Thursdays with either Bill Malone from the Park City Chamber Bureau as well as Todd Hauber from the Park City School District. We also invited the chairs of the Summit County Republican and Democratic parties, Brantley Eason and Cheryl Butler, respectively, to also provide some reporting. Both of them join me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So we'll
Thank you.
Yeah, ladies first, maybe. What, if anything, Cheryl, do the Summit County political parties even do during the legislative session, maybe for the Democrats' point of view?
So I think as a party leader, I think one of my major responsibilities is to open up opportunities for our citizens here in Summit County to get involved in the whole gamut of the political process. And the legislative session that we have going on right now isn't prime opportunity for people to get involved. And so we're making those opportunities available, whether people want to meet with the legislators or track bills easily, or testify in front of committees, go down to Capitol Hill and talk with some of the activists or lobbyists working on various issues of concern. All those are available, and I encourage everyone to get involved.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a little bit. But for you, Brantley, I mean, anything that you're working on to...
Well, absolutely. Along the same lines, it's about getting involved and reaching out. And if you can spend time in the legislature, that's awesome. A couple weeks ago, we had Representatives Wild and Quinn come into town and do a quick little overview of what they're looking for in this session and talked about their bills that they've got going on. So we supported that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Was that done just for Republicans or were the Democrats part of that?
We just opened it up to our party. So, yeah, Republicans.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, would there be some opportunities for joint, just given that those guys are so busy, some joint gatherings like that, since they represent all of us and not just...
We could definitely schedule, set something up. I know, like you said, they're really busy, 45 days of pretty much 24/7. So we could definitely set something up if they've got time.
Yeah. How much time do you spend down at the Capitol, if any?
I was down yesterday all morning. I'm going down this morning right afterwards. So I'm there a couple days at least.
To watch particular bills or?
Well, actually, my wife is a teacher at Ecker Hill. And so we've had she's taken all of the seventh graders to the Capitol. So I helped arrange some speakers. And so all the students were able to hear yesterday, at least from Representative Wild, Quinn, the state auditor, state treasurer, and attorney general.
So, what a great opportunity.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, and then so in terms of any specific dates that you've got, either of you have scheduled in terms of people to get more involved?
We actually had a number of folks with the committee yesterday listening and supporting action on House Bill 12 with the House Health and Human Services just yesterday. So as those opportunities come up, we post them on our Facebook page. It's difficult sometimes to track the hundreds of bills that are moving through the legislature right now. So things change daily, sometimes hourly. And we, as those opportunities come up, we make sure that folks are aware. We've also managed to schedule a number of either meetings with various legislators, both Representative Quinn, Van Tassel, and the State Senate, as well as Representative Wild here, and open those up to folks to voice their concerns or their support.
Yeah. I mean, do they respond to those requests, given that
absolutely.
You know, they know the Democrats didn't vote for them? Yeah.
They do. We have a good working relationship with all of our representatives, and we need to maintain that. As the minority party, we aren't able to affect legislation very often unless we're working closely with the majority. And so we are very careful to make sure that that we're speaking constantly with our representatives, regardless of which party they're in.
Sure. Tell me about House Bill 12. I mean, why is that important to you guys?
So we're really focused in many ways on working families and women's issues. This one provides long-term contraception under a four-year pilot project that and under the state Medicaid program to lower-income women in the state of Utah. It's actually being sponsored by Representative Raymond Ward, who's a Republican. But we strongly support that bill, and it was heard just yesterday and recommended by the House Health and Human Services Committee. So we have a number of Park City residents who are there to support it.
Right. Well, we know it's cheaper that way, right?
So we think, yes.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful bill.
Yeah. Any other bills that you've got on your kind of agenda in terms of?
Absolutely. The folks here in Summit County are usually very interested and concerned about environmental issues. And so there's a number of environmental organizations and bills that are proceeding through the state legislature right now. Concurrent Resolution 1 is on climate change. It's a very impressive resolution that puts Utah legislature saying that they would that they support the science around climate change and that that should be taken into consideration for future legislative efforts. That one, there's another concurrent resolution, number 4. That one is being sponsored by Representative Becky Edwards. Similar, not quite the same wording. So a number of our environmental groups are actively following those two bills. There's additional vehicle testing, emissions testings requirements. The bill under Patrice Arendt, that's House Bill 101. We're following that one. That would require counties that currently have gasoline emissions testing for their vehicles to also include diesel testing. At least one county has exempted themselves from the diesel emissions testing, and we believe it's important to include that as well.
Now, Summit County does not have that emissions testing,
that
nor
correct.
Wasatch County. So is that something that you're interested in seeing happen here?
What we find is quite a lot of our Summit County residents are very concerned about air quality. And even though we aren't under some of those current protections here in Summit County, we care about our fellow Utahns. The science shows that people are literally dying from the air quality impacts in the valley. And those impacts will come to us in the future if we aren't all taking action as Utahns.
Yeah, that concurrent resolution 1 about the climate change, that seems to be 180 degrees from something we saw years ago, the state legislature does not believe in climate change.
It's a major, this is a major move in what we believe is the right direction. So I'm very keen to hear the debate and to participate as it moves forward.
Yeah. And Brantley, anything in particular that Summit County Republicans have on their radar screen in terms of bills?
The one that I found interesting that came up is House Bill 68, sponsored by Justin Fossen. It talks about, well, particularly for parties, how to get signatures and how that route goes for getting into a primary. It limits the number of days and a couple other restrictions on there. So that one's been interesting that just kind of popped up on my radar.
Yeah, something that you would support to limit the opportunity?
It's not completely built out yet. They're still writing it, but the initial view from what I've seen, it's pretty interesting, and I think it needs a little bit more debate, but definitely something to watch.
Yeah, is that something that the Summit County Republicans support, though, is the convention and caucus system?
We do. We do support the convention and caucus system. There's also, as you know, a couple of the state initiatives that are addressing that, so those are also on the radar.
Yeah, but do also support then people allowing to get onto the primary if they can get enough people to say yes?
Well, it's...
because that was the compromise, right?
That was the compromise. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's correct. And then House Bill 68 addresses that, but then it may be a moot point considering what's going on with the two initiatives with Count My Vote and Keep My Voice. So you've got three things that are kind of overlapping. So depending on which one takes over, we'll run with that.
Yeah, how does the Summit County Republicans feel about the ballot initiative process for redistricting?
The redistricting, it's really interesting if you look at who, so for those that don't know, it creates a commission of seven people. And then you've got the governor, and then who appoints one, and then legislative leaders who appoint the other six, basically. What's really interesting, if you look at the language on there, is who can be a part of the commission. One of the things I thought was interesting was that if you voted in a primary, you were not eligible for the commission. So if you voted in a Democratic primary, mm-hmm. voted in a Republican primary, you were not eligible to be on the commission. So, and that's over the last five years. So you could basically look at three different cycles for anyone who voted in a primary would not be eligible. And therefore, you've got the folks that are most involved in the political system that are not able to be a part of the commission.
Yeah, interesting. But my thought was that it was supposed to be bipartisan. I mean, that, mm-hmm. but that's been the problem in the past, is that we've got one party making all the decisions about where the legislative line should be.
That's true. That's true. It is supposed to be bipartisan or nonpartisan. But you also have, say, someone who's a libertarian, who's not in either party, who maybe votes in their respective primary, and then they're not eligible. So it really lowers the pool of active people in the community that are allowed to be a part of the commission. So that's my concern. Well, I mean, things change, so we'll see what happens.
Sure. And anything else you guys want to add in terms of some of those other ballot initiatives that are being circulated? We've got, of course, the redistricting, Our School Now, the medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that the Summit County Democrats have been in the forefront of gathering signatures for a number of the ballot initiatives, and very excited that some of them are nearing completion of getting their well over 100,000 signatures required to get on the ballot for November. Certainly, we're working to get signatures for the Better Boundaries redistricting initiative, as well as the medical cannabis initiative. And Our Schools Now is a school funding initiative that we've been supporting and working with folks to gather signatures for. And the fourth one that we've been really pushing is probably the most recent of those four, is the Medicaid expansion act, which would bring Medicaid benefits to tens of thousands of Utahns that don't currently qualify.
Yeah. So with the number of initiatives like this, does that say anything to you as a Republican, you know, that maybe our legislative leaders aren't doing what some people in the district, you know, want to see? I mean, the fact that we have to do it this way means that it's not being done at the statehouse.
Well, many things are being addressed at the State House. As you know, we've got, I think, over 1,200 bills that have been submitted, and that's quite a few. I don't necessarily think that that's a good thing that we've got that many coming in. But it is part of a citizens' initiative to petition the government and make these asks of the government and of the people. So it's part of the process.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Any parting words, Cheryl or Branton?
You can keep up with us on our Facebook site. I would encourage you to take a look at Summit County, Utah Democrats. And if you want to get more involved, just contact us, and we would be delighted to have you.
And Brantley, you also have a similar page?
Same thing. Summit County Republicans on Facebook and summitcounty.gop on the web.
Great. Hey, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thank you.
It's 8:45 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Park City Board of Education met on Tuesday to begin the recruitment process for a new superintendent as Amber Connolly prepares to step down in June. In the studio with an update on that, as well as some other issues, I have school board member J.J. Ehlers along with District Communications Director Melinda Colton. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So Tuesday's meeting on the superintendent recruiting process, the board met with representatives of the firm, I think HYA, mm-hmm. they presented a calendar of events for the next 5 months with the beginning of May as a final decision time frame. Quickly, we'll be advertising the position February 1st through March 31st. And then, JJ, the board will appoint a selection committee between now and then?
Yes, we will be taking applications for people. Well, that information will be going out soon to be on the selection committee, and we'll be appointing a committee that will go through the initial slate of candidates and help pick some top candidates that then the board will interview.
All right. Board member Petra Butler wondered about having two committees, one kind of internal with administrators, teachers and staff, and the other maybe outside community partners. Do you make a decision on that? Or, I mean, are we just going to stick with one?
It'll be one committee. It'll be probably half and half, half outside, half internal. Part of it was the feeling was that by working together, that they would be able to see different viewpoints of what the different groups are interested in.
Yeah. So who would be on that committee? I mean, is it appointed by the board or do people submit an application or how?
People will need to submit an application, and then we will, as the board, will select a diverse group from that group.
All right. The recruiters urged the board to refer any contacts to them in order to avoid any impropriety. I mean, have you heard from any interested parties that you would need to refer?
I haven't yet, but some other people I think have. We have such a diverse community that comes from all over that people have contacts within different districts around the country that they want to, you know, reach out and give information on. And so rather than us reaching out to them, it's better for the search committee or the agency to reach out to them.
Sure. My understanding is that the firm will be narrowing the applicants down to 5 or 7. So really the board doesn't see anybody's names until then?
We actually will be able to see all names of anybody that applies. We will have a portal that we can go in, and we can look at everybody that applies. They're going to do some initial screening for us, but if we, you know, get on there and look and see somebody that we feel like they missed, we could always ask them to be added to the list.
And Leslie, I think it's important to know, too, that as we start to meet with the public, they can suggest any name, and this firm will basically look at those names, review them, find out information about them, see if they're interested. And so they will be doing all that legwork so the board doesn't have to. And this firm, our two consultants, are both former superintendents. In fact, one is Darlene Robles, who used to be with Salt Lake School District. She's well acquainted with Utah, really understands the state, and I think what Park City values are and those kinds of things. So I think she's going to be a tremendous help for the board.
That was one of the top selling points of the firm. They had a lot of advantages, but that was a big one, was that we would have somebody that knew Utah.
Yeah, and would reach out.
Has those connections. Yeah. She's now at USC in the School of Education.
Board members Peters and Andrew Kaplan feel that the district should pay for those finalists to come interview. JJ, you weren't quite sure on this. I mean, is there a standard procedure on this?
Well, we want to get more information on that. Initially, my understanding from the agency was that it's not that normally the finalists pay to, or the semifinalists would pay to come here, and that we would pay for the finalists. So we need to understand what the cost involved would be in and what difference that might make as we make that decision. We have another board meeting or two before we decide that.
Sure. My understanding is that the recruiters will also perform a community survey, which, Melinda, you'll be distributing through the school text alert system. What will that survey focus on?
What they want to do, and again, those dates on that are going to be February 9th through the 16th. So that's coming up fairly soon. What it will ask them is some overall questions about the district so that the new person coming in knows, are we on the right track? Are we not? You know, kind of a 1 on 10, how do you rate us? And then really, what characteristics are you looking for in a superintendent? What strengths do you want that superintendent to have? Should they be a strong communicator? Should they be based in strong academic and curriculum know-how? So it really gives the community a chance online to be able to express their opinion on what they're looking for in the next person that the board hires.
My understanding was that the board would also schedule one-on-one meetings with any teachers or administrators who'd like to give input. Would that be just a private meeting, or is that something that's open to the public so that we can find out what those, you know, in the trenches want to know?
My understanding is they'd be more like small group meetings. So there might be a meeting with teachers, or maybe two meetings, one with elementary teachers and one with secondary teachers. And the same thing with different community groups and administrators within the district. And yeah.
This morning, just before I came here, I sent the firm a list of all of the different groups of people, and we have somewhere around 26 to 30 different groups that we know from elected officials to teachers, you know, our associations, both classified and educators, ranging from law enforcement to some of the opinion leaders and shapers in the community. So they want to come do those February 5th and 6th, and the board is going to ask them to extend that time maybe 2 more days. We want to make sure that everybody's voice is heard. It's important for the board to have that kind of feedback. Obviously, JJ and the board knows that this is the most important decision they make as a school board.
Yeah. Did the media make that list?
Yes, actually, you are on there, as well as a shaper, like opinion shaper, Leslie.
So how much money do you think will the district have to spend on hiring a new superintendent? I know our business administrator Todd Halber, expressed some concern over the cost.
Mm-hmm. I think we could spend up to $50,000 on this. I can't remember the exact cost right now for what the initial, because things, you know, it's kind of the more you do, the more it costs. So that's one of the things that we're going to have to really take a look at in the next meeting is as we look at whether we fly in candidates and things like that, what the actual costs are going to be.
And that also includes advertising the position.
Right.
Far and wide, the board talked about doing it even internationally, mm-hmm. Coast to coast, hitting all the superintendents and the national association. So Darlene is very well connected and knows where to get all that information.
Right.
Advertising isn't cheap, as we well know.
So we'll see a lot from you then, Melinda, in terms of keeping people abreast of what's going on. And
that's what I've been told. The board has asked me to kind of be that point person. So if people have questions or if they feel like they are not included in any of those focus groups, they can certainly email me through my personal email or through the district email, and we'll get that information to the board.
Board members Tuesday also discussed the retreat, exploring the idea that the school board would benefit from doing a few different team building meetings. One thing, JJ, you brought up was in response to comments that had been made by Superintendent Emmer Conley that she thinks the board needs governance training. You were pretty specific about what you think that the board needs, how to interact with administrators and the superintendent, how to ask questions that don't come across as an attack, how to address the community perception of the dysfunction of the board. And given that the board president has repeatedly disagreed that the board doesn't operate well, I mean, will this training happen?
Yes, this training is going to happen. We are working right now to reach out and find a facilitator that's going to work with us as a board. Once we have Aaron on board February 6th, we're going to have a retreat that's a board retreat to work on interactions within ourselves and become a cohesive board. Work on our how we respond to each other, how we work together, and how we reach out and reset some of our goals and our common guidelines kind of working together. And then after that, I'm going to reach out to the Utah School Boards Association, USBA, and also to some of our community leaders to come in and just work with us on more governance issues, you know, what the board's supposed to do, open and close meeting laws, how we interact with administrators and the superintendent, and just really help us to get on board with those things before we have a new superintendent coming in, so that we're ready for that. And then finally, we'd like to have a retreat with the administration team to really work on how we're going to work together as we move forward with the new superintendent.
Yeah, so did I hear in there that the board will work amongst themselves in terms of how they treat one another as
well?
Yes,
yes, we'll be working together. And that's the first thing we're going to do, is work on us as a board being cohesive.
Yeah, I mean, I think you had suggested perhaps Kim Carson, Summit County Council member who was also on the Board of Education for a couple of terms, maybe Andy Bierman as a potential mentor. Would they all come in at once or individual kind of?
I think that's something I haven't had time to really think through too much. I would like to talk with them and see what they think would be best. It would be nice if we could schedule like a 3-hour meeting, maybe with 1 hour with USBA, 1 hour with a 2-hour meeting with them coming in together, both city and county together to talk with us. We'll just have to see what appears to be the best after we talk it through a little bit and think it out.
Finally, wanted to mention a closed session was held to discuss consideration of censure. Can you tell us what that even means?
That was in a closed session, and we are not moving forward with it at this time, and that's really all I can say.
Tell me what censure is. Is it just a public reprimand?
Yes, censure would be a public reprimand, yes.
So, I mean, are we talking about a person? Are we talking about KPCW that you want to censure? I mean, what?
Definitely KPCW. I can't go into that. That was in closed session.
Board member Julie Eihausen didn't attend that closed session, but because she's on the board, my understanding is that she had to be there as part of this discussion. How come?
I'm not sure I'm following all that. That she didn't have, that wasn't part of the.
So you could go ahead with that even without the entire board being there.
Right.
As long as there's a quorum.
Was a quorum. We had four people there. Yeah.
All right. Did the school board consult the district attorney about this prior to meeting in closed session about a consideration of censure?
I can't comment on that.
You can't say whether or not you called an attorney?
No. I don't think so. Closed session is closed session, so we can't talk about what happens in that.
I guess we could just check the financial records and see whether or not we paid our attorney to address that.
Right.
Last week, board member Eihausen commented for the public record that her concern with President Kaplan should have been disclosed, the wife's friendship with Aaron Grady, and that he should have abstained from voting for her if he'd had personal connections. Aaron was voted to the seat by a 3-2 vote. He said that the accusations were baseless, member Eihausen said that the comments came directly from Aaron Grady, who replaces hers. So I guess, should that have been disclosed? I mean, after all is said and done?
So that is a lot of personal information in there and a lot of he said, she said. And so it's... I'd rather not comment on that. I was not part of any of those discussions.
And, you know, let's say I remember last week, was it last week already, that Andrew was on and he talked about and disclosed here on the radio station, you know, his relationship with her and his wife's relationship and that it really is more on a professional basis kind of, and then also kids going to school, but they've never really had a lot of close interaction. So in that case, you know, my own professional opinion is I don't think it was probably necessary in that kind of an instance.
Okay. Anything else that we need to add?
I had one thing I wanted to add. Jay, do you want to make your announcement about upcoming elections?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we will have upcoming elections next November. There'll be three open board seats. I will not be running again. I'm in District 4, which is north of I-80. Everybody within this district that lives north of I-80 is my district. Mm-hmm. The district that Aaron was, District 5, which Aaron was just appointed to, will be up for election. And also District 1, where Ann Peters was appointed, that was for to finish out a two-year term, and then there'll be election for another two-year term. So those elections will be our to register will be in March. So people need to start thinking if you're interested in any of those positions. Mm-hmm.
And a great time to be on the school board. There will be three open seats, a new superintendent. So just wanted to put mm-hmm. that out there for the community to start thinking about
areas.
Okay. Anything you wanted to add, Melinda?
No.
Okay. Thanks for your
time. Thank you, Leslie.